The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. The podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing is intended as investment advice. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
I'm here with Rupal Bhansali, the Chief Investment Officer of International and Global Equities at Ariel Investments here in New York. Rupal is on the podcast for a specific reason that came across my radar a short while ago, which was a book that she has written, the title of which is Non-Consensus Investing: Being Right When Everyone Else is Wrong. So this is published by Columbia University Press. I believe by the time that this podcast is out, it will be available on Amazon and anywhere else you can find books. Rupal is very well known in the investment community. She is one of the rare female portfolio managers in the industry. And I think you mentioned before there's something like 2% of all portfolio managers are female?
That's correct. Unfortunately, less than 2% of the mutual funds out there are solely managed by a woman. And it's a woefully poor and low statistic. I would really love to do something about encouraging women to enter finance and to break through the glass ceiling and achieve the kind of investment success and career success that I have, which is why I wrote a special chapter in my book, which is the last chapter, as a message to young women to encourage them to be in finance and also how to break through that proverbial glass ceiling.
Yeah, and I know from my experience, I've tried very hard to get women portfolio managers on and have, until you, not been successful. So I am very glad that you have agreed to come on the podcast. Okay, let's get into it right away. Your book obviously looks at this view that investors should maybe be thinking about something other than what is in the mainstream press, on the TV channels, and even in the regular sell-side research, right? That accidents happen in blind spots, and that there is a different lens, a different view that people should have when it comes to investing. So why don't you take it away and tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think what people seem not to appreciate about investing is that not only is it a unique, is a different sport, it's a very asymmetric sport, in that not only do you have to be correct, you also have to be non-consensus, which is to say that in most other things in life, if you get the answer right, you're off to the races.
Right.
In investing, if you guess that Apple is going to make $10 of earnings and you were proven correct, you know, Apple does report $10 of earnings, well, guess what? There is no prize to be had for that correct call because it's already in the price.
Yeah.
So not only do you have to be right, you also have to prove everybody else wrong, which is that your correct call must be non-consensus.
That's right.
And I think that's what people forget about investing. So a lot of research out there is regurgitation, telling you what you already know, rather than differentiated original research where you look at something with a different lens and hopefully a non-consensus one so that you can actually exploit, you know, if your view is correct and others is wrong, you can make the value spread in between, or something that's just being overlooked. And that's a blind spot. You know, people have just overlooked it, ignored it. And often opportunities are found when nobody's looking or not looking at it in the right way.
Okay.
So that's what non-consensus investing is all about. It's doing research in a different way, not just taking the other side of the argument. So it's not about being contrarian for the sake of it, but having a good, validated point of view. When proven right and proven everybody else wrong, you can make a lot of good returns on it.
Indeed. Very interesting. So, okay, so what are investors doing wrong? What are they focused on maybe that they shouldn't be focused on?
So a great example, if you turn on any TV channel or, you know, news media or even newspaper, what you'd find is that everybody in investing is focused on what I would call earnings risk.
Right.
You know, is a company going to miss earnings, beat earnings, meet earnings? That's all the talk. Very few investors focus on balance sheet risk. Is a company going to have difficulty repaying debt? You know, is it going to miss its debt payments, etc.? if you hearken back to GE, you know, for years the stock was floundering because people did have concerns about earnings and the stock was priced at such. But very few people thought about balance sheet risk of GE. And one fine day when they woke up, the stock had reset down 40%. Yeah. And that's because they suddenly started paying attention to balance sheet risk. So I think that's the setup that the entire equity market is exposed to, not just GE, which seems like a one-off, but I don't think it will be, because corporate balance sheet debt, financial leverage is off the charts. And I think that's what's going to come back to haunt equity investors.
Are there any particular, maybe without mentioning any stocks, though if you want to, that'd be certainly be fantastic, but any particular sectors that you think where this might strike particularly soon?
Well, I think, unfortunately, because interest rates have been low for so long, the indebtedness is not punctuated or isolated in any particular sector. It's so broad-based. It's from every industrial company to consumer discretionary company. I mean, it's just so broad-based. Energy, I mean, all sorts of companies, you know, have taken on a lot of debt. So unfortunately, I think it's much more broad-based. It's not sectoral. And unfortunately, it's global. So it's not just true of US, it's true of international. Ironically, the one country where balance sheets have improved the most is the one where people expected the least, Japan.
I was going to say Greece.
No, actually it's Japan.
You know,
Japan
right?
was the first country to engage in QE. It was the first country to try to force rates lower, you know, to encourage its economy to get a sort of get a kickstart. And it did, but in fits and starts. And, you know, it took them 20 years to reset. And ultimately, what has gotten Japan into a much better shape today, because Japan, people don't realize, is one of the best performing markets in the world after the US. It's because the corporates paid down debt and improved the strength of their balance sheets. And this is something that's going to play out in the Anglo-Saxon world. And while the economy is deleveraging in that way, it's actually very painful, just like it was in Japan. And I think investors are being very complacent about that outcome.
Okay, to take the other side of that real quick, though, I mean, if interest rates are getting lower in the U.S., already sub-zero in Europe, won't it be just be possible for companies to continue to kick the can down the road to refinance their debt as we go along here?
So again, the playbook in Japan. Remember, interest rates were low there too. It didn't help GDP growth. It didn't help them to recover. What ultimately helped them to recover is actually paying off the debt. Because debt servicing is not just about the interest coupon. As we discovered in the subprime housing crisis, you know, when people thought if they took an interest-only loan or they took you know, floating rate loan, all they had to think about the servicing costs. And what really came back to haunt is when the values of the houses collapsed and the debt remained high, you know, you got foreclosed. So debt is a noose around your neck that gets tighter and tighter as it becomes bigger and bigger. And it's not just the interest cost. Ultimately, the principal amount has to be repaid.
Do you have some other views in the book about, you know, these FANG stocks? Talk about maybe not the FANG stocks, but many of these growth companies. WeWork has been in the news. But you have this idea that the FANG versus MANG. Tell me about that.
I think that it's important that, you know, as whenever investors' attention is disproportionately focused on one portion of the market or one kind of theme in the market, in fact, it's almost astute investors look at other parts of the market which are being overlooked because that's where the opportunity resides. And MANG is just my way of saying that, you know, FANG is not the way to make money. In fact, it may be the way to lose money. It's a crowded trade. MANG is a lonely trade. And what MANG stands for are companies like Michelin, Ahold, Entity Docomo, and GlaxoSmithKline. And these all happen to be my portfolio holdings. I just want you to be aware of that. You know,
sure.
I manage two mutual funds, and they are present in both of those mutual funds, Aerial International Equity Fund as well as Global, and have been for years. So the reason I call out MANG is, give you the example of Michelin just as one case study. Michelin is viewed as a consumer discretionary because it's in the auto component sector. It makes tires.
Right.
You know, of course, it's cyclical. That's the assumption people make. Actually, if you really look at it from a different lens, we all use tires. We know that they are not discretionary. After a couple of thousand miles or a couple of years, we have to replace them. In that sense, it's a staple. It's not discretionary, except, you know, it's got a longer shelf life as opposed to, you know, a shampoo or something. But nonetheless, it's a staple from that standpoint. And this is a stock that you can buy on 11 times earnings and clip a coupon of close to 3.5%, 4%, compared to if you were to buy your favorite, you know, FANG stocks or even consumer staple stocks, which are very much loved by the market, you have to pay 2x, 3x a multiple and get practically no dividend yield for
usually
it.
Usually none, yeah.
And all stock markets' performance is driven by dividends, not just capital appreciation. You know, that's half the total returns come from this. So I wanted to give you these sorts of examples that actually value can be found in the market if you know how to look for it. And Mang is the place to look for it, not FANG.
Does Michelin, do they trade it? Is there an ADR there? Or do you have to trade it in Paris or London?
I think it's traded in London. Uh-huh. I think it's traded in Paris, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But if you take the other stocks like Ahold, you know,
yeah,
it
sure,
is traded in the US.
Yeah.
Entity Docomo as well, I think that ticker is DCM space US.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It's the wireless phone carrier. Think of it as a Verizon of Japan, except it has no debt. It's actually a net cash balance sheet, generates about, you know, free cash flows that is paid back to us in the form of a 5% dividend yield in Japanese yen terms. Remember, in the long run, the yen is an appreciating currency. And it buy back shares, you know, about 2% a year. So you have a tremendous amount of free cash flow generation, and it's coming back to me. And it's a net cash balance sheet. So not only do I get, you know, this and, I don't have to make a trade-off. You know, it's undervalued. It's got no balance sheet risk. And it's got very limited earnings risk, because if you think about, you know, the fetish that people have with, say, owning Salesforce.com, which is a subscription-based model, right? All of this rage, you know, of these subscription-based recurring models. Well, guess what? Telecom services, if you subscribe to your cell phone and you don't pay your monthly bill, I'm sorry, that's a subscription service you're not going to cancel.
That's right. That's
job
right.
or no job, recession or no recession, it is a staple.
Yep.
So telecoms is the new consumer staple. And that's, again, a lens with which I want you to look at that space. We own a lot of these telecom stocks in our portfolio because, again, they're completely overlooked. They're completely misunderstood, because today most of the telcos in the world make the bulk of their revenues from wireless phone services.
Right.
The days when we were doing cord cutting of the fixed line phones is behind us.
Yeah.
And so this earnings stream is far more resilient. It is subscription based. It is actually a recurring revenue stream, and it's recession proof. And not only do you get these stocks on 10, 11, 12 times earnings compared to, again, your classic consumer staple stocks, which are 2x at multiple, you get coupons, you know, dividends of about 4%, 5% on many of these stocks in strong currencies.
Interesting.
So that's the kind of value you can find if you approach it with a non-consensus lens. But of course, I talk a lot about this in my book as well. And I teach people how to identify, you know, these sorts of opportunities, but also how to identify the blind spots so that we don't have an accident in our own portfolios.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, it's interesting that telecoms are, you know, they've been out of favor for 20 years. So that would certainly be a bit of a contrarian call. Lastly, I wanted to ask you, going back to your book, and you have, I believe, the final chapter is specifically addressed to women who want to get involved in investing, right?
Actually, it's a special message from me to young women to get involved in investing, to become financially literate, you know, to not be afraid of choosing finance as a career. Because less than 25% of women go into finance. And even in very difficult and challenging fields like the legal field, you know, the medical field, which are also equally demanding professions, you know, the proportion of women is 50%, which is in line with the population. In finance, women are woefully underrepresented. A lot of times, because I think women are just afraid of it's all cut and dry, it's all numbers, and they're not very interested. I can tell you that actually finance is a very interesting subject. All the cut and dry stuff, which is, you know, Excel spreadsheet modeling, number crunching, it's done by Excel. It's pre-programmed, all these formulae. What you really need to understand about finance is that it actually is not just about financial models, it's a lot about business models. And that means you have to think with the left-hand side of your brain and you know, and right-hand side of the brain, because business model is about understanding strategy and creatively understanding, you know, how the company is going to be run, the competitive landscape, and so on and so forth. The financial model is simply an outcome of a business model. And so I think people, young women in particular, are very afraid of finance, afraid of numbers. They think it's boring. Many people think it's full of scumbags or windbags. You know, unfortunately, our industry has a bad reputation.
Right.
And I think most of it is just not true. And I want to dispel that myth and really encourage women. And I write this sentence in my book, which I want to reiterate. You know, it's as easy as learning cooking. You don't learn cooking on day one.
Right.
And you know, every dish is different. And, you know, you got to learn it and you got to do it. But very few people are afraid of cooking.
That's true.
Yet many people are afraid of finance. And I would say it's the same. Approach it the same way.
Yeah, that's not a bad point. and a good way to leave off. Rupal Bhansali, thank you so much for joining us. And please do check out her book. I will provide the link in the show notes as well as anything else. So thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
This concludes our podcast episode for today. We thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe to the podcast, follow us on social media, and get in touch with any questions or concerns at PodContrarian on Twitter, ContrarianPod on Instagram, or email contrarianpod@gmail.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next week.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org, paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.